eat a greater proportion of the cake so as to increase the size of it. Mr. Jack Kemp is the originator of the Kemp-Roth bill, which calls for cutting by an average of one-third individual income taxes, the purpose of which, human charity apart, would be to stimulate the economy, reduce unemployment, and ultimately diminish inflation. Mr. Kemp is attacked from some quarters on the right, which is traditionally opposed to tax cuts without compromise. Left all those who, as a general principle, oppose a diminution in taxes, lest the country face the horrifying prospect of permitting the people to spend their own money rather than let the bureaucracy spend it for them. Mr. Kemp is dogged on the point, and his popularity perversely rises. It is difficult actually to see how this can happen, given that last time around 78% of a district, 50% Democratic, voted to send him back to Congress, and the time before, the disastrous year of 1974, he was returned to Congress by the heaviest majority of any Republican congressman in the United States. Mr. Kemp was born in California and educated at the Occidental College and at the University of California in Long Beach. For 13 years, he was among the most celebrated professional football players in the nation, serving as quarterback for 280-pound tackle, reducing him to serving as special assistant to Governor Ronald Reagan. He was elected to Congress in 1970, and all kinds of things are whispered about an even more illustrious future. Our examiner today is Mr. Jeff Greenfield, about whom more in due course. I should like to begin by asking Mr. Kemp to explain. I had a blackboard here, which all of a sudden has disappeared. Would you like to draw it? We can then put the camera on it if you find that would be easier.
Well, I can draw it or explain it either way.
Yeah, this is the famous
as you like. As you like.
Well, first of all, thank you for that gracious introduction. I appreciate it. I didn't retire from football until 1970, although some of the people think I quit playing back in 1965. But Professor Arthur Laffer at USC has basically rediscovered, I think, the maxims of taxation laid down by Adam Smith in 1776.
Here's a here's, by the way, is the
all right
thing for
and the so-called Laffer curve is just based upon Adam Smith's maxims of taxation, that they should be fair and they should be equitable and they should be distributed according to people's ability to pay, all of which have been talked about. But the fourth maxim was they should never be raised so high as to discourage the industriousness of the people. And therein lies the secret of what Professor Laffer drew on a napkin at the White House in 1971 or 1972. He just basically talked about that fourth maxim, that taxes can get so high as to discourage people's industriousness and thereby become counterproductive.
Yeah.
Not only lowering production, but losing revenue for government. So if this were the revenue line and this were the tax.
Yeah, you draw line. It and give it to me,
okay.
And then you point, and then the cameras can focus, I think, better on it. Or maybe they can see it now. Yeah, fine, go ahead.
All right.
Go ahead.
It basically says that there's two points at which taxes yield no revenue, at zero taxation, but at 100%. There's no revenue for government. It's 100% production. At 100% production, people cease to produce, or they go into the barter economy or the subterranean economy, talked about so articulately by Professor Gutman at Brook College. And that you see what has happened in New York City. The subterranean economy is overtaking the productive economy, but more about that later. So what Laffer was drawing on a curve or on a napkin was basically this curve, which simply says that as long as taxes are fair and equitable and distributed according to people's ability to pay and encourage their industriousness, production increases and revenues result from an expanding tax base. But as taxes go up where they're discouraging, marginal businesses go out of business, unemployment results, the cost of government rises, revenues drop, and this is...
Where does he put us now?
Well,
on the downward slope.
Everybody has their own version. Everybody thinks on the margin. Every worker thinks at what point they become discouraged in terms of looking for work, or become discouraged at the price between leisure and work. Investors find on the margin what the trade-off is between investment and consumption, or entrepreneurial activity, and say a tax shelter or a tax-free municipal bond. And so Laffer, and the person who really is written about the Laffer curve in a world perspective, Jude Winiski of the Wall Street Journal, who's written a book, The Way the World Works, to show how this global political economy works, estimate that we are in the upper ranges of this curve, where lowering taxes will not lose revenue. It will, quite the opposite, increase production, encourage investment, encourage work, return the reward after taxes for saving and entrepreneurial activity, thus leading to revenue, not losing revenue. So I would generally say that Sweden and Great Britain and New York City are in the upper ranges, very high upper ranges of the Laffer curve. New York State obviously is in the upper range of the curve. And the country somewhere is at a point at which people's production has been discouraged, their efforts, their output, the entrepreneurial instinct clearly has been eroded in our country, and particularly in Sweden, the Netherlands, and in Great Britain. And nations that find themselves in the upper ranges of taxation in terms of not the first dollar of tax, but the marginal dollar of tax on the last dollar that's produced during the week, find themselves losing revenue. I can't tell you what this is. It's a point of general equilibrium at which people are willing to maximize their effort and their output and still pay taxes. I would say somewhere around 25%, maybe 30 at the very most. But beyond that, people on the margin, Bill, start to look for alternatives. Leisure, consumption, tax shelters, idleness, subterranean economic activity, and bartering. And we clearly are at a point in our economic history in which, particularly with inflation moving people through the high progressive tax rates, we are discouraging the type of economic behavior that leads to high production on a low tax base. What we have is high taxes on a low production base. We need to reverse it, and that's the theory behind the Kemp-Roth Tax Rate Reduction Act. Lower the tax rates.
Now, the economic consulting firm of Norman Auteur was retained to try to trace on some sort of a model the effects of the passage of your legislation, and he estimated that there would be a very considerable rise the first, the second, and especially the third year, since yours is planned as a phased-in measure in GNP and therefore in the tax revenue. But he also predicted that the first year there would be a net increase in the in the deficit of $21 billion, rising to $81 billion in the third year. Does this correspond with your analysis?
Well, Dr. Ture, was an economic consultant, actually, to the Ways and Means Committee in 1963 and 1964, when Wilbur Mills, as chairman, and President John F. Kennedy cut the tax rates by 30% right across the board. And I want to make a very careful distinction between taxes and tax rates. The purpose of this is not to just cut taxes by one-third to put money out into the economy. That will be an effect, of course. But we're trying to lower the tax rates, the marginal tax rates, to return the reward after taxes for investment and savings and thrift and work and entrepreneurial activity, such as that accomplished under President Kennedy's one-third tax rate reduction in 1964. So Dr. Ture estimated that it would be a net increase in the deficit. Not the first year, Bill, but the second year. The first year, there would be no net loss or not net increase in the deficit. But the most important part of the Ture study, of this whole economic act, this tax reform measure, tax rate reduction measure, would be that the capital stock of the country would expand. You'd be able to finance a deficit without monetizing the debt, which is inflationary. I would suggest that you could better finance a deficit in an expanding capital stock, and as you expand the savings of a country, it is far easier to finance whatever short-term deficit you might have by borrowing than it would be if you had to monetize through the Federal Reserve actions, which is inflationary.
Is it assumed by your projections that the foreign capital would come in at a faster rate than it now is?
Yes, it is, but even more important, you would tip marginal decisions that are now going towards leisure, idleness, consumption, tax-exempt securities and shelters and subterranean type of economic activity. You would tip those decisions, you would change the economic behavior of people from non-productive uses of capital and savings into very much more productive uses of capital. The mistake I think that some of our conservative friends have made, they always look at the first dollar of tax. They don't look at what the last dollar of tax does to the economic behavior of people. And I think the best way to explain it, if I could just take a second, because sure. I think this is really important in explaining marginal behavior. If you took the whole economy and shrunk it down into, say, a year's output, into 1 7-day week, and you thought of a tax system that taxed Monday's income at 10%, Tuesday's income at 20%, Wednesday at 30, Thursday at 40, Friday 50, Saturday 60, and hypothetically Sunday 70, then you ask the question, at what point during the week would leisure become more attractive in terms of foregone income than work? At what point would a tax shelter look far more attractive than an investment in a factory or an entrepreneurial activity?
You'd start getting pretty long weekends, wouldn't you?
You would get very long weekends. In fact, you can see that with inflation moving people up through those marginal tax brackets, we have taxation without representation. We are reducing the reward for the saver and the investor and the producer and the worker. And thus, the incentive in our economy that should increase output rather than diminish it has been eroded, particularly in the last few years since we went off, since we closed the gold window, since we took away the currency from a fixed exchange rate.
Yeah, and we do, of course, have the historical experience of the Kennedy proposals. It was predicted at the time that over a period of 6 years, $89 billion would be lost in revenue. In fact, $54 billion was gained. That was an experience in the 60s. How do you handle the argument that a reduction in taxes is really insufficient, that the so-called hurdle rate for businesses is now only one part taxation, but is in considerable other parts other things, like environmental protection laws that are excessive, regulations, bureaucracy, and so on and so forth. Does the Kemp-Roth bill take that into account, or does it simply hope that by the reduction in taxes, those other hurdles will be bridgeable?
Well, let me make 2 points. Number one, regulations, paperwork, the frustration in the economy between one's commerce and one's reward, the barrier between individual effort and individual reward, the wedge, in other words, is growing. All of this is part of this wedge, this growing
right.
gap between
yeah.
A person's individual effort and one's individual reward. So as the regulations, the paperwork, the frustration, the hiring of tax accountants or tax lawyers or complying with regulations, as that wedge grows and grows and grows, commerce, production, effort, output, the supply side of the economy is diminished. And quite clearly, it is extremely important in looking at inflation that we operate not only on the demand side of the equation, but we operate on the supply side of the equation. And most economic theory today, conservative in some regard and liberal in much regard, is working on the demand side of the economy. There aren't enough people focusing in on what increases production, what increases supply. So very clearly, this is only a step. It is a very important step, and the reason that I spend and Senator Roth has spent so much time on this as a first step, as a strategy, is because so few people have ever put together the linkage between tax rates and the output of an economy. We're not the first, but we certainly have tried to revive the strategy of President Kennedy and Secretary of the Treasury Mellon in the 1920s, and West Germany and Japan and those nations of the world who clearly clearly removed bias in tax code between against savings and thrift and capital investment and workers. So I would only make one last point. I apologize for taking such a long answer to this question, but I think it's extremely important to point out one further aspect of this in terms of the human behavior of politicians. I contend that when the pie is shrinking, when you get economic contraction, such as we've had in the last 7, 8, 9 years, I think the pressure on the body politic builds up for, you know, regulatory, for excesses, for carving up the pie in a more egalitarian way. People want to protect what they have today. And as this barrier builds up between people's effort and their reward, I think you get excessive government interference because people think this is a way to preserve or protect their share of the pie. You get that pie growing, you get the tide rising, you know, lifting boats all across the board, I think you reduce some of the excesses.
Yeah. People tend to substitute political for economic activity for enhancing their situation, and everybody looks for special protections. I think that's true. Are you aware of the studies of Colin Clark in the late 40s? Because he arrived at the figure 25%, which was the Bible of Senator Taft, and interestingly enough, earned a favorable comment from the great Keynes shortly before he died.
I am familiar with Colin Clark.
His thesis then was that any country that taxes at a rate higher than 25% of the GNP will develop at a less than the at a lesser speed than it otherwise would. 25%, of course, is something that we passed years and years and years ago. Now, let me ask you this.
Incidentally, Senator Taft was the first person in the United States Senate to ever introduce a one-third reduction in all the tax rates. He did that in 1946, he did it again in 1948, and he did it again in 1952, and he was frustrated by those Treasury officials in which Herbert Hoover is still living, apparently, at the White House, who think that any reduction in tax rates automatically relates into a loss of revenue. This is the static mentality that has operated at the White House level ever since Herbert Hoover, that was, I think, overcome by the Kennedy experience, and I think needs to be overcome again. The linkage between tax rates and tax revenues, I think it's very important that people understand there's a big difference.
Let me ask you this. To what extent do you, sitting in Congress, feel that there is a general public recognition that inflation plus progressive taxation has the effect of making steeper the progressive graph every month or significantly every year? Do people understand that easily, or is it something that's difficult to explain?
I think even congressmen can understand that.
Well, they certainly don't know anything about it.
I think they're beginning to understand it. There's a growing movement to index the tax rates, as you know.
Yeah, I've heard about that. How much pressure is there from the public? I didn't say the Congress understands it. Obviously, they do. But is there pressure from the victims of it?
Well, I was being facetious. The people understand it very well. I said even congressmen can understand it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the people. I spoke at a United Steelworker dinner in Buffalo Saturday night, and I think something like 14 out of 15 people who were interviewed all recognize that they're being, you know, squeezed at all levels. The point that I made, Bill, is that if you took $15,000 income in 1965, it takes $30,000 of income in 1978 to keep up with a $15,000 income of 1965, but the tax rate goes from 22% in 1965 to 32% at 6% inflation. By 1987, just 10 years henceforth, at 6% inflation, an individual to get $15,000 in 1965 will have to earn $60,000 to keep up with the purchasing power of a 65 income. But the tax bracket would have gone from 15% to 22% to 32% to 50%. I mean, I perceive that if something isn't done to lower the rates, they're going up so rapidly that by 1985, 1984, 1983, workers, working men and women at between $12,000 and $18,000 a year, are all going to be somewhere around 50 to 55% in the marginal tax brackets, and that is not only unnecessary, it's intolerable, and it's counterproductive to the output of our economy.
You were talking to an audience of steel workers whose income level would be approximately what?
15, 18.
So they would qualify as middle-income Americans. And according to these figures, people who earn in excess of $15,000 a year pay 72% of all the taxes raised, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So that the burden does fall very, very sharply on people who earn $15,000 a year. And that progressive rate begins to clip them at a very considerable speed, so that in fact it is extremely difficult to grant them an effective raise under the existing system, isn't it?
That's really important. That by lowering the tax rates, you reduce the wedge between the employer and the employee. And I am not an economist. I am fond of saying that I understand incentive, and I know why workers work. They work not for the gross wage, but for the after-tax wage, just as the investor invests not for pre-tax reward, but for after-tax reward. And if the after-tax reward for work and savings and investment increasingly becomes diminished, you get less of that type of economic behavior. By lowering the tax rates, you make it easier for employers to hire, employment picks up, you remove someone from the government transfer payment side of our economy, and you put them into a position where they can actually pay taxes and contribute to the tax system of our country. I don't think people mind paying their taxes if they perceive that they are fair and equitable and that they are distributed according to people's ability to pay, but they must not discourage people. And the whole thought behind this is not a Keynesian thought that we just want to pump money into the economy. We want to restore the reward, restore the incentive for working and producing. In other words, get the type of economic expansion that can only come as you increase the reward for that type of economic behavior.
Well, has something happened in the past season that is politically significant? We know that in the last couple of years, three or four referendums or propositions or whatever were defeated in Utah, Montana, and so forth, whereas Tennessee recently, one was passed, and the one in California seems to be extremely popular. Is this the year of the tax revolt, as some people herald?
I don't know if this is the year, but I think it's a year. I think we're in the middle of it. I think the impact of the subterranean economy that Professor Gutman talked about at Brooke College, where there's almost, he estimates, $200 billion of economic activity outside of the money economy and simply circulating in subterranean fashion, cash, fringe benefits, anything that will escape the tax collector. That is an aspect of this tax revolt. People looking not for wages, but for, you know, for non-taxable fringe benefits. Unions who are looking for time off or fringe benefits or the mine workers, I think, is an example to a certain degree of people who don't really, who are concerned about how much of a bite government is taking out of the wage side of their reward. So 2 weeks ago, for instance, I introduced this amendment. I introduced this bill as an amendment to the Humphrey Hawkins bill to see how it would do, just kind of a test case. And I said, as one of the goals of Humphrey Hawkins, by 1981, all the personal tax rates will have to be lowered by one-third, the corporate rate will have to be reduced by 10%, and the surtax exemption for small businesses to expand their, you know, capital investment opportunities would have to be doubled. It got 194 votes, 20% of all the Democrats, 98% of all the Republicans, and came within 11 votes of Kerry. I think that really was a manifestation of not only how popular it is politically and economically to talk about a permanent restoration of incentive by lowering the rates, as opposed to the Carter tax reform that simply redistributes income and really doesn't get to the heart of the problem that the American people are facing.
What were the most effective arguments used by the Democrats who opposed your measure?
They sounded like some old conservative Republicans, and I say that with affection, because I've been there before. I spent my career talking about the deficit and high interest rates and disintermediation and crowding out, and I don't want to sound like I'm not fiscally prudent and responsible, because my voting record certainly reflects that. But the argument that was used against lowering the tax rates was that it was going to cause disintermediation. It was going to lead to a higher deficit, that it was going to traumatize the economy. And I kept making the point, I think it has to be made, that unless you are in favor of lowering the tax rates, by definition, you're in favor of raising them, because they're not going down unless Congress does something about them.
They're going to go up.
They're going up. They've gone up 144% in 11 years. So Congress, if it doesn't take a positive act to reduce them, by definition, those who voted against it are raising them. Now, the argument against that was that it was going to lead to a tremendous increase in the deficit. Well, those people were operating in a static, partial equilibrium model that suggests a dollar of lower tax rate translates into a dollar of lost revenue, not recognizing that at 70%, no one invests. Most people at 70% or 60% or 50% or even 40%, if they're pushed into Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in our tax code, basically they're going to either choose leisure or idle their productive capital, or they're going to look for tax-exempt securities and non-productive uses of this very scarce resource.
Their economic libido tends to dissipate, doesn't it? Well, those Democrats who found philosophical reasons to oppose you, did you find them stressing some of the old-time Democratic religion that, after all, this money lost to the government meant less opportunities to redistribute, to build more OSHAs or whatever they're doing?
I think if you really get down to the basic philosophies of the two, the two parties, the Democratic Party clearly has been the party of redistribution. They really believe that spending creates prosperity. They really believe that taxes are the way of channeling resources through a far more beneficial, political process. In fact, I was debating the author of the Hawkins-Humphrey bill, and he literally said, Jack Kemp, to an audience, Jack Kemp wants to cut your taxes and let people spend their own money willy-nilly. And I said, you're right. And I really believe that that's what freedom of choice is all about. Government must do things, and I recognize that, and that's one reason why we're not cutting tax rates to lose revenue. We're cutting tax rates to restore a tax base and try to gain revenue. I really think we can gain revenue, just as happened under the figures that you mentioned under Kennedy. But I think it is that is where they are locked into. They really believe in the Keynesian economic model, which suggests income redistribution is the function of government. And I believe in that the Republican Party clearly should come down on the side of income growth. It should clearly come down on the side of getting that wagon loaded. It should clearly come down on the side of economic growth, and then let the other party be the party of redistribution and hold out this option to the American people. And I think therein lies the secret of broadening the base of the Republican Party. It does not lie in getting in the wagon and unloading that wagon on behalf of another constituency. Yeah, I think clearly what Margaret Bush Wilson is talking about at the NAACP is that minority Americans, young Americans, blue-collar Americans definitely want economic growth, job opportunities, and a chance to get those rungs back on the ladder upon which they can climb and achieve a greater independence and dignity and income for themselves.
Well, your proposal is really not, in any sense that I can think of, anti-Keynesian. In the first place, I don't think Keynesian was really a redistributionist in the egalitarian sense. He was a redistribution only because he reasoned that there was a higher, what he called, propensity to consume among people who earned less, and under the circumstances when he sought to invigorate the economy by increasing the velocity of the money in order to achieve an equilibrium between saving and investment, he figured that taxation rate ought to be steeply progressive for that reason. But it wasn't simply to spread the wealth around. It was in order to increase the velocity of money. Now, the Kemp-Roth bill does not rest really on, and you don't have to repudiate Keynes in order to be in favor of your bill, as far as you can see, do you?
You don't have to repudiate Keynes. What I know about Keynes, it basically was, as you say, a demand side, a consumption side economic theory.
Mm-hmm.
But this whole model upon which Kemp-Roth is based and upon which Kennedy based his tax rate reduction in 1964 was definitely aimed at the supply side of the economy, the production side of the economy, and was definitely not just trying to cut taxes to spur consumption. Mm-hmm. It was aimed at trying to increase the supply of goods and services and thus bring about employment opportunities for people in the private sector of the economy.
Now, you have endorsed the Jarvis proposition in California, have you not?
I haven't endorsed it formally. I don't know that anybody's ever asked. I definitely would like to see the tax reduced on property, not only in California, but more importantly in New York State.
Yeah. The Jarvis bill is criticized in part because it doesn't phase in the way your own bill does over a three-year period. Is that, do you think, a lethal defect?
I don't think it's lethal. Not at all. It's more static in the sense that it really... I think you've got to reduce progressivity, not only in the United States, but in California, where they have a very high graduated income tax. A 10% increase in nominal incomes in California raises tax revenues to the government in Sacramento by 20%. In New York, our income taxes are so progressive that a 10% increase in nominal incomes raises taxes by 16 to 17%, and at the federal level, it's almost 15%. So as people are pushed up into higher and higher brackets by inflation, moving them upwards, they end up seeing their nominal incomes reduced in terms of the higher taxes and the reduction of the purchasing power of their currency. So I think not only in the United States, but in those states like New York and California, they must reduce progressivity. And I think that Puerto Rico is taking strong steps towards reducing progressivity. The world must reduce its progressive tax rates. The third world basically have very steeply graduated tax rates, and in so doing, they are discouraging the type of economic output and economic expansion that is so necessary to provide opportunity for people. The one nation, for instance, in Black Africa, that was highlighted in the New York Times just a few weeks ago, that has very low progressive tax rates is the Ivory Coast. I think there's a correlation there between low taxes and high growth. They have a high per capita income compared to the rest of Black Africa. Capital in Black Africa is flowing to the Ivory Coast. There's less unemployment, less inflation, more political stability, and you feel like there's a reward there for effort. But Ghana, which won its independence from Britain around the same time that the Ivory Coast won their independence from France, has 98% marginal tax rates at $4,000 of income. You can imagine where capital is flowing out of Ghana, and people are flowing out of Ghana. And I think New York State is a good example of how that works.
Capital punishment, whoever cheats.
But, it ends up that. Ends up that. Italy, of course, if you leave the airport in Italy with any of your own money, you're arrested, as we find out with some of the...
Sweden, I suppose, takes the prize because they've figured out how to have 110%
Ingmar
Bergman was... on certain circumstances, yeah. Mm-hmm. And...
Sir Francis Crick, the Nobel Prize winning scientist, was going through Philadelphia the other day, and they asked him why he left Great Britain. Why is he moving to the Salk Institute in La Jolla, California? And he said it has something to do with the 83rd percent marginal tax bracket on income, ordinary income at $35,000 or $40,000. Now, on investment income, which they call non-productive income, but on an investment income in Britain at $35,000 to $40,000 of taxable income, the tax rate is 98%. So Rolls-Royce is doing well, but entrepreneurship has absolutely been choked and strangled.
Why is it that your bill, which proposes a 1% reduction in the business tax for three succeeding years, is less audacious than President Carter's, which wants a 4% remission right away.
I think he's talking about a 4-point.
Four point.
I'll be glad to accept President Carter's reduction of the corporate income tax rate. I think it'd be have a very positive influence. But unless you reduce the steeply graduated and progressive income tax rates, you are really, I think, not going to get to the heart of the problem that working Americans and investing Americans and entrepreneurial-minded Americans are suffering today. And so I'm not saying that mine is the only answer. There are other answers. I know that Bill Steiger, my colleague from Wisconsin, is introducing an amendment to the Carter tax reform to roll the capital gains tax back to 1969 or pre-1969. I'm strongly in favor of rolling the capital gains tax. In fact, I would abolish it if I had my druthers. I'd like to get the top rates down to 25%. I think these are just steps in the right direction, because it is clear that America, since 1969, has seen a diminution of investment. The market obviously is a reflection of the lack return on equity. And we thus see that the burden of taxation has shifted from upper income to those on the lower levels of income, because they are the ones who go without the jobs. They're the ones who go without the tools of production. They are the one who suffer just like everybody else from inflation and economic contraction. So this economic theory is not to be thought of as a middle class one or just a poor or just the wealthy. We want to lower the wedge or lower the rates on all income and put economic expansion back into the United States economy.
A change of 11 votes would have carried your measure in the House. What is your political strategy? Do you intend to bring this up again in the next Congress and hope that there will be sufficient backing for it, whether as a result of new Republican votes or as a result of converted Democrats?
Well, I haven't given up. The Ways and Means Committee is discussing tax reform. As you know, President Carter has a tax reform message, or a tax reform policy, which basically lowers taxes on people below 16 or 17,000 and raises it on everybody above 16 or 17,000. And George McGovern, back in 1972, found out that wasn't very popular. It wasn't good economics, and it wasn't very politically popular. He dropped when he offered the $1,000 rebate, to the American people, to everybody who earned less than, I think, than $16,000.
I thought it was everybody who voted for him.
Yeah, well, the Gallup poll showed a precipitous drop in his popularity, and someone after the campaign was over asked him, why do you think you dropped so much in the polls after you offered 61% of the American people a $1,000 tax cut? And he said, I never realized there were so many people under 16,000 who someday hope to earn more than 16,000. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really the problem suffered or from which the Carter tax reform is suffering. People see this as an increase in progressivity, thus compounding the problem that they have with the tax code. It's going to be offered in the Ways and Means Committee bill by Barbara Conable, or at least the Republican side. And then Steiger is trying to roll back capital gains. So this thinking is, and Senator Baker is also going to offer it in the Senate, so with Senator Roth's help. So there are many more votes. We look forward to a continuing debate and showing the American people who is on the side of restoring real growth as opposed to just spending their time redistributing income.
Mr. Jeff Greenfield is our examiner today. Mr. Greenfield is a graduate of the Yale Law School, an author, and a contributing editor to New York Magazine. Mr. Greenfield?
Thank you. Congressman, I don't suspect that it's politically unpopular to call for tax cuts. In fact, everybody seems to be doing it. President Carter has a tax cut proposal. It's hard to find anybody who's against it. But I thought if I could ask you a couple of questions, we might get at some things that I think may be left out. Now, when was the United States afflicted or burdened with the highest rate of taxation in its history, offhand?
Well, the rates before Kennedy reduced them were 91% on investment income and something like 70% of ordinary
income.
It was
World War II, in fact, I believe, that we had the highest rates of taxation in our history.
Had a surcharge, yeah.
Now, what interests me about that is that many of the things you were asserting about the point at which we tip from a productive, work-oriented philosophy to other values. Those weren't around in World War II. And we had a black market, we had our share of shirkers, but by and large, most people look back on that period as the period when America, in fact, was probably at its most productive. So that it seems to me that something other than high tax rates or low tax rates has to be factored in to explain that. Would you not agree that might be
true? Of course not. I would not agree with the premise upon which your question is based. The real income of the American people in World War II dropped. All of the Keynesian economists love to point to World War II as a great example of Keynesian economic theory in which government was directing the resources of the nation, when in fact we had to draft about 25 million men and women to achieve the type of full employment that could not be achieved in the 1930s.
Either I misstated or you misheard me. I wasn't talking about real income. What I was saying was that the fears that you cite from high taxation, indolence, not working the extra 2 days, a subterranean economy, in fact, I would suggest to you, not only did not take place, but were replaced by something else. And what I'm suggesting to you is that something other than a pure economic decision was put in the minds of the American people, not just those drafted or those who enlisted, but those who worked here at home. And that was a unified public policy towards something beyond the fulfillment of personal economic gain, namely the salvation of Western democracy.
May I say that in the curve that I drew earlier in the show, I would have said that there are times when a nation could be taxed at a higher rate in which the good of the country is at stake. I'm sure that when Stalingrad was under attack by the Nazis in the 1930s, they probably operated at something like 99% taxation. So that does not... But in peacetime, you must lower the rates. You've got to get back to the bottom level of that curve because it is totally unproductive to tax people
the same fact that the post-war inflation simply took it all away.
No, you keep coming back to the point that of real economic gain. I was talking about something else.
What you're saying is, can you flog people into hyperactivity without paying them? The answer is yes, you can.
That's what you're saying. What I'm saying is,
in a non-free society,
is it possible that there are free societies who, despite high rates of taxation, maintain a level of public participation and public free voluntary willingness to pay those taxes because there is evidence that, unlike our own country, the taxes are spent for a purpose? What I'm asking is whether or not your position denies even the theoretical possibility of a well-governed free society taxing its citizens at effective rates even higher than our own, but returning to them benefits not just economic, but safety in the streets, free medical care, sense of communal purpose, the end of unemployment and poverty, to which free citizens might repair as much as they would repair to the promise of a mobile home or another freezer.
Well, I would make the point that Bill made earlier and Professor Colin Clark made at one time, and I think even Keynes recognized that when you tax a people beyond 25 or 30% of the national income, you get to a point at which the choice that they have is diminished to such a degree that they're no longer really free. They're working not for themselves and their own interests and their own agenda. They're working for the so-called public good.
That
diminishes the reward. I would suggest that Sweden today and Great Britain today are good examples of nations where they have attempted to follow the path that you have outlined and find themselves in the type of contraction. Indeed, I think at $11,000 of income, an ordinary income in Sweden today, a worker on a Torslanda, Sweden Volvo factory, is in the 60% marginal tax bracket.
But, yes.
I would suggest that the level of output is going to be diminished whether one is Swedish, whether one is English, whether one is a black African, or whatever.
Not only that, in Sweden they do vast amount of business under the table. It's everywhere acknowledged. There are two prices in Sweden.
Well, and also, Jeff, you said there was no subterranean economy or no black market in World War II.
No,
there was
He said there was.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, it's just a minor detail. But the interesting thing is that does it bother you at all that despite the ritual flogging of the Scandinavian countries, that at least according to Edmund Stillman this week in the New York Times, the four nations with higher standards of living than our own, namely, he cites Sweden, Norway, Denmark, and Switzerland, all have effective tax rates much higher than ours.
They can't exist, though, on the upper end of that curve. This is an article by Leonard Silk in the New York Times, The Swedish Sickness, Gloomy Economic Picture. There is an economic contraction going on in Sweden today. I don't want to flog anybody. I am interested in my own state, in my own area, of creating, you know, jobs and economic expansion, and I don't see any place in recorded history where you can get both at high rates of taxation, because you must tax the private sector in order to finance public sector expenditures.
Congressman Kim, I, unlike perhaps some other people, do not cite Scandinavian countries or Switzerland as any kind of utopia. They have problems. Mm-hmm. We have problems.
Well, sure, for
we
sure.
have 9 million alcoholics. I don't subscribe that to either high or lower tax rates. The question I asked is, how, well, we're not talking here about per capita income, because mm-hmm. Kuwait would come in there. How is it that the four nations with higher standards of living than our own all have higher tax rates than ours?
Well, in the first place, Switzerland doesn't, just to begin with. But go ahead.
Nor does Great Britain.
I didn't cite Great Britain.
Well, who do, I don't...
Stillman cites the Scandinavian countries in Switzerland. You can take that up with him, Mr. Buckley. I mean, how does this happen? Is it a law?
Well, Germany is not has a higher, or is achieving a higher growth rate than the United States. And they have the highest rate of savings. Japan has a higher rate of savings. Switzerland has a higher rate of savings. There is a direct relationship between the amount of capital invested per capita and the level of production of an individual.
But they also have a lower inflation rate. The answer, Sweden and Switzerland are sui generis. Sweden has a cultural homogeneity, which is often remarked, and it causes certain sociological opportunities that simply aren't shared in other parts of Europe, and people have remarked this. However, there is a widespread consensus that they rang to the end of the line. To be sure, also they took considerable advantage from the fact that they didn't fight a world war recently, which devastated, for instance, Great Britain.
All you are saying by that statement is what I was trying to say in the first question I raised to Congressman Kemp, which is there may be other factors that explain certain things about how a country lives. And I think in some cases, indeed, there are. Maybe I could ask you...
I didn't understand that Mr. who write articles for academic quarterlies work for nothing.
Don't look at me. I'm the last free marketer around. I'm a freelance writer. We don't... very few subsidies for that. But the question that I was... mm-hmm. trying to get to was that it seems to me that one of the reasons why Americans are as fed up with high taxes and why it's such a powerful political appeal, whatever the merits, because I mean you don't lose a lot of votes by urging lower taxes, is because unlike other high tax nations, we seem to get so little back. Now, whatever we think of the Scandinavian countries, and I'm really not interested in that kind of debate, they do have universal health care, free. Now, it may not work the right way, and there may be a barter system somewhere with doctors, and doctors may be coming here, but they do get that for that 45 or 55% rate. We don't.
Yeah, now,
They get it,
but it's also true that Sweden has not had a Statue of Liberty sitting at the bottom of their main harbor for a period of 150 years. And under the circumstances, they simply do not have the problem of taking people, as we have in the case of tens of millions, who arrive with zero capital and, in effect, carry them economically.
The point I was making, to say it again, is that I'm suggesting the possibility that one of the reasons why this appeal is so powerful is not just that we are taxed heavily. I mean, I live in New York City. You don't find a more highly taxed, unsheltered individual. But that we don't get back what we think we get back.
I would agree with that.
And what I'm interested in is that in the Kemp-Roth proposal, in fact, you've been criticized for this, it's as though you were looking at an enormous, overfed machine fueled by our tax dollars. You want to lessen the richness of the fuel, if I can use that analogy. But you're not talking in this bill about dismantling anything. I mean, in that sense, Ronald Reagan and his $90 billion tax transfer...
Why should we talk about dismantling anything? You don't need to dismantle anything. You just hold government spending constant, keep a steady, hand on the monetary throttle, and by that I mean don't allow heavy monetization of the debt, you don't need to cut back severely or cut into severely into public spending programs. You don't need to.
You think the Social Security system can continue the way it does?
Let me give you an example. Well, Social Security and the problems in the trust fund of the Social Security, yeah, I think, are directly attributable to the declining rate of growth in this country. We've had such a low rate of growth on a real basis that it has shrunk the wage base of our country. And when you shrink the wage base of the United States, you are directly impacting severely and negatively the Social Security Trust Fund.
Don't you think the population base may have something to do with it? That we have more and more people over 65 and a lesser number of people coming into
the workforce? But the 1% or less than 1% real growth rate is a far greater threat to Social Security and even the demographics today in comparison to what they were when the Social Security system, that is a threat. But I say no growth is a much greater threat to Social Security than the demographics of a declining payroll base. But let me make another point. The unemployment-related transfer payments in America today at the federal, state, and local level are upwards of $200 billion. Now, I'm not suggesting that we cut into the program to reduce that portion of expenditure that's being financed in the public sector. What I'm suggesting is if you get economic growth, you put someone to work in the private sector of the economy, you restore the climate for entrepreneurial activity in America today, you're not only creating a job that pays taxes and increases revenue for government, you reduce the need, as Irving Kristol says, for government services by taking them out of the food stamp, welfare, unemployment syndrome, and transferring their economic output to the revenue side of your economy.
We've had three federal tax cuts in the last 15 years?
Oh, no. We've had five in the last 8 years, and all of them have been Keynesian. All of them have increased the progressivity of the tax cut. The interesting thing is, though,
that the structural unemployment among the people that Mr. Buckley was talking about earlier, those people who can't fend, has gone way up. This is a specific question. What would your tax cut proposal do to make more possible the hiring of the structurally unemployed absent either repeal of minimum wage or job training programs?
Well, let me make a point that I think that there's high structural unemployment for a couple of reasons, one of which very clearly is the drop-off in entrepreneurial activity in America, which most affects small businesses, independent businesses, the new ventures that might get started up, you know, from a franchise to another type of small independent operation. When 1969, when Congress raised the capital gains tax, almost doubled it, at least in 69 and 76, the assault on capital gains has just diminished severely the amount of venture capital necessary to expand small businesses, to start new and independent enterprises. Well, and there is the most labor-intensive part of the economy. 60 times more jobs are produced in small independent enterprises than are going to be produced in, say, a Fortune 500 type of a business. And if you really want to get at the heart of structural unemployment in America today, we not only should roll back capital gains tax, we should probably repeal it and reduce the high levels of taxation, which I'm trying to do, on entrepreneurial activity.
Excuse me, just one second. I've got to finish
because I want to reduce the wedge at the bottom level to make it easier to hire an unemployed person.
If the incentives aren't directed at hardcore unemployed, at structural unemployment, the way Robert Kennedy's tax bill was 10 years ago, Robert Kennedy had a tax incentive bill. In fact, you even praised it, Phil, 10 years ago for jobs and housing. And the point of it was a shotgun. I'm sorry, it was a rifle, not a shotgun. Under your bill, they can build anywhere. Yeah. They can build in the suburbs. Well, how's that going to help the hardcore unemployed in the cities?
I still believe that a rising tide lifts all boats.
But some of the boats have holes in them.
Secondly, no one else has figured, no one else is strategizing on a major step towards economic expansion. Everybody needs economic expansion. Not only the hardcore unemployed, but middle income and everyone else. Those blue-collar workers in Buffalo, New York, that I represent, are not structurally unemployed. They need an expansion of economic growth in our country, and it is to that end that I think we are trying to design this. Secondly, structural unemployment, as I said, will be resolved not just by taking this as the only step, but by taking this as the first step it is a very important step, and it's one that Congress has not addressed. People say, you spend too much time on this. I only spend time on this because no one else is spending any time on anything other than simply trying to cut taxes in a Keynesian fashion that only increases the progressivity of the code. I have no interest in simply trying to throw money out into the economy to spur consumption. I'm interested in restoring incentive and trying to get economic growth at all levels, and particularly in the entrepreneurial.
Yeah, I'd like to comment also that what Roger Starr calls the institutional poor, that is to say, those whose poverty is traceable primarily to the lack of an ethos, is a poor concerning whom macro remedies do not apply. But those macro remedies can result in an increased national surplus, parts of which can be used with whatever other programs or apposite to sustain those. Roger Starr says, after all, there are some people in New York City who simply won't flush a toilet. Now, that has nothing to do with economic incentive. That has to do with the deep demoralization.
You know, that view of what we have in New York and the other gators, I think, is a singularly cynical and also wrong-headed one. And one of the things I do believe is that, I mean, it's not even that far different from Congressman Kemp's, although I think the result is. I think that results from a situation where you have had an economy grow up in which chunks of it, no longer the majority, but chunks of it, have never offered the slightest glimmer that there was any jobs to be had for certain numbers of these people. And I would suggest this is what the NAACP is talking about.
Yeah. They know.
There are pathological problems, which I don't think Mr. Kemp is here to talk about. He's talking about people who are looking for work and can't find it as a result of what you so properly call the wedge. The distance between what a man receives and what somebody has to pay to hire him is a reflection of this huge overhead that is the principal accretion of 20 years of thoughtlessness in Washington. And it is not to suggest that he's in any way indifferent to the pathological problems that you point up, that this might be the way to help the overwhelming majority.
Is there time for just one more question or not?
Yeah, 30 seconds.
At some point, if Mr. Touré is right, you're going to be faced with an enormous deficit at which
no.
the question is going to
no.
come. If he is
no.
right...
No, that's not true.
Well, he says it's $80
no.
billion dollars by 1982
no.
total.
No.
So you don't regard it at any
no,
point
the expansion,
you're going to have to...
Don't misquote Touré. He's saying that the growth of the saving stock of the country
yes.
will more than adequately finance any short-term
but the point
deficit.
Of, right,
but there will be such an expansion of GNP that you will not have the problem of monetizing...
Of crowding out.
Thank you, Congressman Kemp. Thank you very much, Mr. Greenfield. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Ron, I know that was not specifically related to Proposition 13, but it was in the sort of domain that you're interested in. This that follows is a recording made this weekend, that is on the 17th of June, at Massachusetts University, at a seminar on the future and science and world games and so on. I'm including some Xeroxes of some material about the program, because in addition to the comments that you'll hear on Proposition 13, Stuart Brand, the fellow who's talking and who is one of the most interesting people in America, I've included a Xerox about him from a book about Jerry Brown, who I think is the most interesting politician in America. But Stuart Brand, in response to a question I raised about nitinol, which I think is a fascinating and profound breakthrough or discovery or something, because it is quite new, and I think it could be harnessed fairly easily as a direct transformation of solar energy into mechanical power via the atomic change, which really is unique to nitinol. And I don't think anybody's picked it up yet. In fact, there was a sense in the audience, who include a lot of people from nearby universities and Yale and Harvard, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and there was a sense of considerable surprise at some of the new stuff about nitinol that is brought up here by Brand, who discusses the new development in which it is discovered that nitinol gains strength with use. It becomes more efficient the longer it's used. I think the implications of that ought to be looked into. Anyway, I'm sending some stuff on that because it's my current enthusiasm. And I've also included some of the material that you wanted, and I'll send more as soon as I can get some together. I'll send it every several days as more material comes out. It's dominating most of the newspapers and magazines here. So here's Stuart Brand on Proposition 13 and Governor Brown's reaction to it. This is fresh stuff. And the other are his, the rest of it is his comments on nitinol.
A lot of foreign investors, governments and other, are investing in America, I'm told, because they regard it as an unusually stable government, an unusually stable system among the ones they have to choose from on the card table today. In a sense, that may be stabilizing. The more you think something is stable within reason, the more it is stable. We've absorbed, and maybe I have sort of a Gaia hypothesis of economics by now, but air is the air of the planet. The Gaia hypothesis that the air of the planet is a byproduct of the life on the planet to protect the life on the planet from various perturbations, changes of sunlight, going from anaerobic to aerobic life, fairly serious events over the years, and that they tend to damp out these things. My feeling is that a political system that has room for a wide range of strangeness can buffer a lot of serious dislocations. And something that gives me increasing thought that may be the case is watching California and the thing that's going through right now. Proposition 13, which I skimmed over in the governor's news summary only 2 months ago, as I have no interest in, that tail is now wagging the whole dog in California, and with it quite a lot more. Friends who just came back from Prince Edward Island said the radio was talking about nothing but Proposition 13. And here we have a almost Maoist cultural revolution coming not from the top, maybe not from the bottom, but from the middle. In any case, it's coming. It's, I think a real big, serious, interesting, probably beneficial correction of an overweening, something that went too far. The government went too far in California. It's gone too far a lot of places. And Brown, as near as I can tell, maybe this is endorsement, after resisting it because it's going to mean a lot of work, it's not an ideal instrument for doing what it is trying to accomplish. Once it was clear that it's what the folks wanted, and he believes that the folks know more than he does, now it's going with it, in a sense giving it back, saying, okay, we have to assume that this means that you and your family and in your community and in your neighborhood are willing to accept more responsibility for people that you formerly turned over to state to take care of mental institutions, hospitals, and whatnot. We have to assume your sincerity in wanting this. We will have to act accordingly. And it's the main thing that the state government now has to do, and it's like a kick over anthill in Sacramento, is to take this sudden change in requirements and turn it into a gradual shift of behavior. Well, I think this is something that America, the American system, and the doubtless other systems, is rather good at. So that many of the things that Dennis Meadows says will be serious dislocations, what if we run out of tungsten or phosphorus or believes in this, that, or the other as being money, as being what will keep us going. I think there's more give in the system than his computer programs show. They're extremely sophisticated computer programs. They're not as sophisticated as the world is. They're not as old. They don't have as many. I mean, if I threw something explosive out here into the audience, most people wouldn't be hurt. Someone would probably catch it and throw it back. In any case, they would see it coming and get out of the way. And it's not like somehow the apocalyptic images are always that we're all puppets of the CIA and of various, you know, whatever the bad guys are, and we are caught on those strings and we can't move. I don't think that's the case. People literally move out from under whatever problem's coming up. I mean, all I have to do is look out here in the yard and see, what is it now, 20 or 30 different wood stove companies making money, responding to something. And over time, 73 at the energy thing. So I don't share Dennis's view that the 80s will be that bad a crunch, or that if government has less money, that it'll automatically be a horrible thing. And I feel that way about NASA. As far as that goes, if NASA can close down tomorrow, and there'd be a great sigh of relief in the Kremlin. And they would go ahead with their space program. And the Japanese Launch Center at UNAM would go ahead. The French would go ahead. The Germans would go ahead with their two programs. They're making it known what they feel about what's happening on the way. However, they've got two-thirds of their fellow citizens convinced to do different than what was just done. And there may be a backswing. Proposition 13 may have gone too far. You'll certainly find, and I gather something like 38 states now are considering similar activities. I don't know what the, you know, this may mean a lot more people going into individual business, doing what they did in the public sector, in the private sector. Maybe those things won't get done. It's something to watch, obviously, very closely, and try, if there is this desire for less government, try some other modes to make less government than this particular MEAT Act, Proposition 13 is. But it, I'll tell you, the will of the people is no small thing when you're in front of it. And leadership means, in part, you know, staying in front of it so you don't get trampled. And this is, I think, what has to be done in this kind of situation. And also, when you're going to squeak, your wheels squeak good like you just did. Down in front. Yes.
A couple of years ago in Coevolution Quarterly, you ran a story about nitinol or nitinol. I've never heard nitinol. I've never heard anyone pronounce it. I understand one of the people associated with the research into nitinol has sold the rights to his particular plan of using it to run the world to Israel for a dollar. What's happened with nitinol as far as you know?
I didn't know about that sale. Oh, yeah, man, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Nitinol, I don't have any on it. Has... not stopped, was it? It's a strain of metal which no one knows the principle why it functions, but it's a steep bear calls it heat muscle. It's just nickel and titanium, and depending on what mix of nickel and titanium make it of, it's a strong alloy. You get these wires, which you put them in cold water and bend them, and put them in a coffee cup with hot coffee in it, and it jumps out of the coffee cup because it straightens with considerable force. And a fellow named Ridgway Banks, who worked with Trubin in California at the Lawrence Livermore, Lawrence Berkeley Lab, has made an engine, which we demonstrated once in the governor's office, that is, it's just a bunch of these nitinol loops hanging down, and you have a bath of cold water and solar heated hot water, and you sort of dip this thing down in there, and it's a wheel, and as it touches the water, it takes off and starts spinning. Direct conversion of temperature difference into mechanical energy. Fascinating. Weird business. I think it's sort of like hypnosis, that it's kind of... it's not respectable because no one knows why it works. Except that it does. And so poor Ridgway has gone along for years now with this engine going through its millions and millions of cycles. Not only is the stuff not fatigued, the loops that are constantly flexing, closed and open, they appear to have gotten stronger. And not only do they still do this thing of remembering their shape and forgetting and remembering and forgetting and remembering and doing this flexing, they've gotten fiercer at doing that. And he says they've developed a double memory. So that they not only straighten with force, but they, when they get over to the cold bath, they bend with force. This is close to organic behavior, I think. It's getting out of this metal. And the efficiency of it increases with use. Fascinating. So far as I know, we ran an article on it, what, 3 years ago? Yeah, 3 years ago. And I don't think there's been, maybe someone knows, has there been any other articles about nitinol? Government stopped production, but they resumed just recently. And it isn't just the government that's producing it. It's in the public sector, nitinol as an entity, because it was invented by the Navy, the naval ordnance lab at the Nall parking lot. I forget what they had in mind, antennas in space or something like that. I guess they were just waiting for a good alibi to stuff to go off on the blob. But it's out there. They're manufacturing it again, and I think they're about to go into enough of a mass manufacture that it's not as expensive as it was. It was like Sandoz acid for a while. A small amount of nothing that does nothing. Same thing. Nevertheless, it's very easy to produce, and all we got to get is enough people using it. Does this sound familiar? Six or seven people working with Nikon. They all like each other. It's not a competitive situation. They know that whoever gets the breakthrough is going to be providing jobs for the other six or seven. It's rather benign, slow operation. Another thing it does, maybe you can find out a use for this, is your upper lip is more sensitive than many other parts of your body to temperature. And so you can take this straight thing, put it against your lip, and bend it. And it gets hot. And then when you have it there bent and hot against your lip and straighten it, it's cold and chilly. I mean, colder than room temperature. Push it down the stairs, it'll be cold by the time it gets hot. Clear and dark. Yeah.
That's it, Ron. I think the rest of this is tape of a seminar on drugs in California or something. Anyway, I won't bother to wipe it, and I'll be in touch with more information soon. By the way, just to be sure, can you just drop me a brief note to the address that you sent the other one to, and let me know if you actually get this.
Or not, somebody asked whether it would be all right for us to use LSD. He told me specifically an instruction which I have followed since he gave me, which has to do very much with what Ralph was talking about the matter of set. He said, if you are in a cool place and you're feeling much peace and you're alone and your mind is turned towards God, you may take your yogi medicine. Now, I got a great deal out of my social experiences with psychedelics. And the thought that I would never again take psychedelics with another person just upset me at first. Now I understand that what I am doing here on Earth has to do with the process of becoming free. And that process is extended most by my practices that have to do with my relation between me and God. And LSD, meditation, service, all are equally valid methods for me as vehicles for becoming one in the universe, becoming free so I can be right here with you in joy and delight. And I don't see that any one method is particularly better than any other. There are different strokes for different folks. And the predicament is that every method is also a trap, because methods have to be transcended. And that includes the use of acid as well as everything else. And includes meditation. You have to be what it's about, finally. And if anything, as I met Tim last night, and I meet Ralph, and I meet Alan again and again, and as I met John Beresford, and all sort of people that come up out of the past for me, I am delighted to see that we meet in a lighter and clearer space. Less clinging, less heaviness, less busy being somebody who we think we are. It's as if it's more a gathering of nobody special. And that, to me, is a delight. That's the proof of the pudding. Because it feels to me that it's about time now all of us have a responsibility, not to anybody else, but to ourselves, to realize that we are a statement of all we've been doing with our consciousness all these years. And it's not so much the words we're saying, it's what we are and how we're living our daily lives. And we didn't curl up and disappear because we were the bad guys in society. We're right here. We feel love, we feel compassion, we're present, we're involved, we're being responsible. People like Stephen with the farm, Alan on his in his work in Buddhism, certainly my work in prisons and dying, and Ralph's work as therapist. I think all of us, Tim's work in outer space, Gutzel of Pitten, whatever that's about.
I'd kind of like to speak to some of that stuff, too. I really like what Ralph had to say about picking up some things from the Indians in the Peyote meeting and putting that to a use. And there's a thing I feel at this meeting. I don't usually get out to this sort of thing too much, but there's a thing about this meeting that I feel that there's a direction that is very important. And you know, I love Tim Leary and Dr. Hoffman for their Promethean efforts in bringing fire and having the nerve to turn it loose to the people. And I honor them for that, you know. But I have to say that I think to turn this kind of energy toward the idea of outer space is wasteful and absurd, because not all of the folks is going to go to outer space. There ain't a Chinaman's chance, if you'll pardon the expression, that all of them is going to go, or that even very many is going to go, and whatever space trip goes down is going to be a very elite trip, and it's going to be many generations removed. I feel that some of the most important works I feel strongly about is Dr. Lilly's in trying to preserve a relationship with the intelligent species on this planet other than us. And I think that when we talk about these psychedelics, that we should, as Dr. Hoffman did last night, honor those organics and those people who've been taking this stuff for 25 or 30 or 50 or 100,000 years, you know, and those shamans who worked out all these games generations and generations and generations ago, and whose territory we, the Judeo-Christian, Indo-European, wonder-bred people of the world have copped their land. And if we talk about that we are going to be more compassionate, we should look to some of the folks and really see what we can do about preserving those other endangered species, the traditional people of the world. You know? And that one would think that a real research into consciousness would cause a great compassion to come upon you for the poor people of the world, and that we would turn ourselves in that direction. I think that the real difference that is here today is a synthesis. When I was in San Francisco, I remember being in an apartment and saying, it's going to really confuse things for all those political people to grow their hair out. Isn't that going to confuse the issue terrible? And when I went out of San Francisco in the caravan, I looked back at San Francisco and I saw, if you got as far away as about Kansas City, that you couldn't tell the hippies from the Hell's Angels anymore. It was just all one great big old weird mishmash, as far as the rest of the people in the country was concerned. But nonetheless, whether they understood it or not, I have to say that the power that came through us 10, 12 years ago toppled a couple of presidents, changed governments, stopped war, and that was a power of love and compassion and communication between people. I think that acid is a powerful communication.
I feel somewhat curious sitting here and listening to statements, almost all of which I agree with, from Richard Albert and from Allen Ginsberg and from John Lilly, Gaskin and the Farm. But I can't agree, for example, though, that it's the legalization, the ability and widespread availability of LSD and other psychedelics are irrelevant. It doesn't make any difference if we can get it when we need it. A lot of people can't, and a lot of people are still in prison because they did. And even though I agree on one level that acid's okay because it's not necessary, there are other methods to get to those spaces. I know that for me, and for many people I'm very much in love with, we couldn't have gotten to those spaces without LSD. I have meditated, and I was able to meditate because of my LSD experiences, really. I never would have gotten anywhere without them, as far as raising my consciousness one tittle. And as far as the explorations in outer space, well, I go in outer space, a lot of us do, but I want to come home, and my home is here. And my first responsibility is to my home, and I want to save it. But, you know, there's no need really to clap about anything about this. I want to live here, I want my children to live here, and I want to save this, my home. And we're all aware that our home's in great danger, and we really don't know if it will be saved in the sense that our species can continue to live on it. So I want to, just for a few minutes, say something about how I think we can do something, as we did with the war, to get ourselves in a position where these drugs can be used and can be used by anyone who wishes to use them. And it's really rather, it's a political analysis that most of us are very much aware of. And the presupposition of all this is that I believe, as I said earlier, that these drugs are necessary for most of us to be able to break our programming sufficiently enough to have some hope of getting to our totality, to where we can be loving and compassionate and understanding. And I think the awareness that we need to act politically is simply this. We all know how drugs are used and passed along. It's private, essentially. It's between consenting parties. As soon as you understand that, you understand, or you can understand, how do the police, the drug police, how do they know when a drug crime has been committed, where it has been committed? There's nobody who is making a complaint to the police. There isn't any evidence usually, except accidentally by stopping a car or going through someone's luggage at an airport. The only way they can do this is by having an elaborate intelligence system. One that's so elaborate that they can penetrate private lives. So you have wiretapping, electronic surveillance, undercover agents. But all that's for naught, really, unless they have a target. They can't, you know, tap everybody's phone. They'd have this incredible amount of data, and how would they find out what they want? You know, the World Trade Center is full of data and just a little bit of incriminating data. So what they need, the essential thing for the drug law enforcement, the technique with which it cannot be enforced, it can never work, is the informer. At least 90% of all drug busts, by the narc's own admissions, are through informers. All those cases are made by informers. Now, who are those informers? They're us. I mean, it's you and I. You get busted, you get a choice. You cooperate, or they give it to you as much as they can. That's coerced informing, right? And they have tremendous power. They have the whole punitive power of the state behind them. And if you've ever thought about how come over the last 50 years, this continual escalation of penalties, like finally culminating in the 1973 Rockefeller Law, where you can go to prison for life for very minor offenses. It's because that penalty structure facilitates the recruitment of informers. And when they go for those laws, when they go to testify for them, the law enforcement people, the district attorneys, they don't talk about deterrent effects of the penalties. They talk about the facilitation of informers. All right. Those informers, what they're asking to do when you get up there and they say, you give us some names, you set, and of course they have you set people up. Or you're going to go 15 years, 10 years, life, whatever. When they do that, what are they asking you to do? They're asking you to betray your friends. Your friends. Now, in a country that was founded as a citadel of private liberty against state power, that's not an anomaly. That's a total renunciation of the principles upon which this country was founded. Does anyone here know why the Pilgrim Fathers, the immediate cause of the Pilgrim Fathers coming to this country? You know, you all know about freedom of, you know, practice of religion and all the rest. Well, the immediate cause, though, was that they refused to subject themselves any longer to coerced informing. There was the High Commissions of Elizabeth, then the Star Chambers of the Charles that followed. And the way those institutions, what those institutions were, they were the arm of the English crown for rooting out and punishing political and religious dissenters. And when you were called up before the Star Chamber, it was very simple. They knew who you were. You were Quaker, a Puritan, whatever. And they had a simple rule of procedure, compulsory testimony. And they said, well, who are some of the people who believe as you do? Who are some of the people that are helping you bring in that heretical literature from Holland? And if you didn't name names, off you went. Just like when you get busted, you don't name names, off you go. Okay? Now that's what the game's all about. The drug laws are totalitarian. Not, it has nothing to do with the drugs. It has to do with the fact that they can and do use this, the punitive power of the state to make people betray their friends. And that is, that is no condition for free people. The Puritans left because they realized that the choice between going to prison and betraying their friends wasn't compatible with freedom. And all of us sitting here who don't organize and do something about these laws, just as we did about the war, you have to understand, the war was a few years. This thing has been going on, this punitive, coerced informing has been going on for over 60 years in this country, and people aren't aroused about it because you just hardly ever read about it. I mean, you just don't read about it. And one of the reasons is that the police aren't interested in talking about it. And of course, and reporters aren't much interested in digging into it. Informers rarely get to the stand because they drop informers out of the cases usually before legally they could get them to the witness stand. Because once an informer gets on the stand, juries tend to acquit. They don't like informers. And it's very, they think of the informer as the classic stoolie. Of course, it isn't that. It's just some person like you and I who have been coerced into behaving as dishonorably as anyone can.